You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 31 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And it is now after Thanksgiving, which means something very important in the Seattle beer world.
What does that mean? I actually knew. I just wanted to play dumb for the question.
You sounded really sincere when you asked the question. That means that from Fremont Brewing Company, what I consider one of the best Seattle beers you can get all year, has been released from Fremont Brewing Company, and that is the B-Bomb Bourbon Barrel Aged Winter Ale.
So we passed on going on Friday night when they have the grand unveiling of the B-Bomb, but we're able to make it down there on Saturday to avail ourselves of some of the limited number of bottles that you're able to purchase per person.
Now, I mean, it's not that hard to get any more B-Bombs. If you want them, you're going to be able to get one, right?
Yes.
But I would consider the coffee cinnamon version of the B-Bomb, which is going to be released. I saw a tweet today from Fremont Brewing Company. I think December 10th, they're going to release the coffee cinnamon version. That, for me, calendar year 2015, number one beer of the year.
Intriguing.
Not even close, really.
Wow, you didn't even think it was a competition. So we had the coffee-infused version of the Dark Star when we were at the Fremont Brewery, right?
Yeah.
And our mom enjoyed the Dark Star we had on Thanksgiving so much that she went out and purchased her own bottle of it.
Yeah, that was weird. That was definitely the first time that our mom has bought an $18 bottle of beer.
For sure. I don't think mom even normally buys $18 bottles of wine.
No, cases of beer.
Yeah.
As we found out, as we discussed last week, our mom is only aware of Mac and Jack.
But now she's got beer number three that she knows of.
So let me read to you about the Bourbon Barrel Abominable. Lovingly referred to by Fremonters as the B-Bomb, this bourbon barrel-aged edition of our winter ale has a warming, spicy aroma and rich, caramely notes of bourbon, wood, and vanilla added to dark roastedy, chocolatey malt flavors, and subtle hopping.
Intriguing.
From Beer Advocate, it's a 97, considered world-class.
Yeah, that's pretty high because that's not the one that overinflates all the ratings, right?
Yeah, no. Rate beer over... It's probably 150 on rate beer out of 100. But it's very high. For Beer Advocate, a 97 is very good.
That is.
Also, as you know, you're drinking a fancy beer if it has wax over the top.
It also makes it harder to get open. That's yes. Actually going to be the entire podcast. It's just you trying to get this beer.
Wait for it.
He's trying.
Oh, no, this didn't do that. I thought I was going to crack it right open.
You were so cocky. Oh, there we go. Second try did do the trick there. Now you've just got some wax stuck on the bottle opener.
Yeah, that's going to be there forever.
Okay, fair enough. All right, pour this. Let's try it. So before we try this, I wanted to tell you, I have a little surprise for you this week.
Oh, no, do you?
I do.
I don't know. I said, oh, no. I mean...
It's not audio this week.
It's just an audio clip because those are my favorite.
There was a Radio Ethan shout out to me that I thought about doing as an audio segment this week, but decided against it because we've got a lot to get to. But I do have a surprise this week, and that we have a new website.
We have a new website?
We have a new home on the internet.
This shows how involved I am on the back end of the Peltoncast that I didn't know this.
Well, I wanted to keep it a secret until I was ready to go. So we have been operating out of the same blog on WordPress.com. Mm-hmm.
KCPelton.wordpress.something.
Yeah, I've been blogging there for like 6 years, which makes no sense because I actually have my own website where I could set up my own WordPress blog. And I have finally done that at SonicCentral.com/Peltoncast.
Still under the Sonics. Oh. I thought it was going to be Peltoncast.com.
I might eventually buy that and redirect it, but that's where it's at right now. So you can take
Wow, you're showing this to me live?
I am. We've got the logo on there.
Wow.
Got some... It looks a lot better than the other one, even though it's still the 2010 version of WordPress, because that was the one I found easiest to customize.
Great. I'm always wondering, you set up a Peltoncast Twitter, how long it'll take for the Peltoncast Twitter to get more followers than me?
It'll have to start tweeting a little bit. By the way, that is delicious.
Is it? There's one tweet ever from there, and it has 15 followers, I think.
I assume I'm going to be able to set it up now that I have this, that it will automatically tweet out the links. So also follow at PeltonCast, and maybe follow Tristan if you're so inclined.
Yeah, don't do that.
Oh, you don't? You don't want to encourage people? You're not even going to give your name?
Yeah, no, give my name, at Tristan Carcino. It's mostly just me talking about ghosts and Krampuses.
It is. That's true.
Well, I'm going to try this, but a toast to B-Bomb Day.
Yeah.
B-Bomb season is finally here. We actually have a couple of these aging in the garage.
That's true. Yeah.
And supposedly, if you age these suckers 3, 4, 5 years, they taste amazing. It sounded like I was saying that sarcastically, but I wasn't.
Yeah, it really did.
Every year I want to age a bottle, right? And then once we get to be 5 years out, then we can start drinking those on the podcast.
It's actually an investment strategy that you've come up with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I forgot I wasn't going to say that we're going to pour some out for the old WordPress blog now that we don't have that anymore.
Oh, I thought we were pouring one out from Mark Helfrich.
Oh, we should maybe pour out a little
bit
from
Mark
Helfrich.
He'll be on the coaching staff next year. It's okay.
You think so?
Yeah, he'll be on the Husky coaching staff.
Oh.
Not on the Oregon coaching staff. He'll be on the Husky coaching staff.
Replacing someone who gets hired as a head coach?
That could be. Or special assistant.
Yeah, he could fill this year's Jeff Tedford role.
Yeah, I like
Mark
Helfrich.
Before getting hired
at
Fresno State next year. No, I mean, I don't think
you
Jeff
predicting
Tedford's,
that Jeff Tedford's going to get fired that fast?
That was just a joke. Also, Mark Helfrich, not an alum of Fresno State. It would be hard for UW to get him his job
at
his...
Where is he an alum of? Oregon?
Oregon. So, oh, yeah. No. It would be hard for us to get him that job.
No, that's a good thing. Oh, this is good. It's also 14% alcohol.
That's true. So we'll have to be careful. The podcast may really go off the rails by the end. We'll see.
But should we talk about sports?
We should talk about sports because...
Wait, what was your Ethan Strauss clip that you're going to pull out?
Oh, I decided not to play the actual audio.
Oh, okay. Do you want to summarize it?
He was asked whether he reads my stuff. Is this character who's like a shock jock radio host who obviously doesn't believe in stats, and his reply was, no, I don't read computer.
Okay, that's
that was pretty good. Yeah.
So computer, can we talk sports?
Well, actually, again, a toast.
A toast?
Yeah, to the Sounders.
Oh, to the Sounders. We have a lot to toast about.
We do. Advancing to the MLS Cup Final for the first time in franchise history with a 3-1 aggregate victory over the Colorado Rapids, including a 1-0 shutout in Sunday's return leg in Denver.
A mandate going into Colorado and winning, being the first team all season.
You said they got a mandate?
Yeah. You like that?
It was an electoral landslide?
Yeah. Being the first team to go into Colorado, they didn't win by default. They didn't draw 0-0.
No.
Right? They didn't lose in a win. They went into Colorado and won the game.
Jordan Morris coming up with a big goal shortly after halftime, and conveniently enough, right during halftime of the Seahawks game, one of the rare times that people in the Seattle area were actually watching this game.
Yes. Unfortunately, we had to watch the rest of the Seahawks game after that.
Big mistake.
It was kind of amazing. I mean, I was wondering, let's talk about the magnitude of this. What does this mean, right? Because you were still upset at the end of the day, even though the Sounders had advanced. Like, okay, let's say the Seahawks advanced to the Super Bowl.
I mean, it's partially...
anything else could happen in the world of sports, and you won't care.
That's true. It's not like if the Huskies played like the same day as the NFC Championship game that one time, and it wasn't like if they had lost that game, it was be like, oh no. I mean, I think the order of operations matters a little bit. If the Sounders game had been played after the Seahawks game, it definitely would have buoyed the whole thing. Like when the Seahawks beat the Patriots at the end of the weekend, where the Huskies lost to USC and the Husky basketball lost to Yale. Like, that still felt like a good weekend because the Seahawks happened last.
You were depressed at the end of a day that the Sounders had their most important victory ever because the Seahawks lost a regular season game to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
It's true. I mean,
when
that does
more or less clinch the NFC West.
That does speak to the relative importance of the two teams.
Okay.
As does the fact that we had the Sounders on the streaming and the Seahawks on the TV. Although
it would have been complicated to have the Seahawks on
the TV. Yes, we couldn't really stream them. Yeah, I mean... I don't know. I struggle with where to place this. Is it bigger than the Seahawks, like a Seahawks playoff win? Probably not.
Okay. Overall, teams winning the highest achievement that they can achieve, right? Seahawks Super Bowl is the most important.
Well, I don't think at this point it's the most important.
What would be the most important? Husky football national championship?
Husky basketball national championship, because it's the one that hasn't happened. I mean, Sonics winning the title is obviously number one.
I guess. I mean, because it implies a lot.
I mean, also, Sonic coming back probably
Sonic
ranks ahead
playing
of...
playing a game would be ahead of the Sounders winning the MLS Cup.
That might be ahead of anyone else winning a championship, to be honest. Like, that's obviously the most important thing.
Number one is Sonic's playing a game.
Yeah, Sonic's coming back. I mean, playing a game sounds weird. It's not like, oh, it's opening night against, you know, the Memphis Grizzlies. This is the most important moment in Seattle.
That's what you're saying, though.
I'm saying the moment when they actually come back.
Okay.
Like, that's going to be a bigger, that's going to be as big of a party as a championship, don't you think?
I don't really know how I'll react to that.
Yeah, it's hard to predict. It's not something that's ever happened before.
In Cleveland, but... Cleveland.
But not to us, I'm saying. We've only seen the reverse of it.
Yeah.
Which weirdly was a party in its own right, but a much different tone.
Wait, what is the reverse of it?
When the Sonics moved.
Oh, okay.
That was the reverse of it.
I don't know if I'd describe that as a party, but...
Yours wasn't a party. I drank a 40
all alone and passed out at like 8 o'clock.
That's true. That's a story we'll have to tell another day.
That's it. That's the whole story.
Okay. Yeah, so Husky basketball to me is number one.
Sonics play a game, then Husky basketball.
Husky football.
Okay.
Because that has happened in my lifetime, but I wasn't really... I didn't get what it meant. No recollection
of this.
Because at that point, I just assumed, oh, the Huskies always go to the Rose Bowl. That's just what happens at the end of the season.
Do you think it's different if the Huskies... Because they didn't win outright national championship. If they were to win under the playoff model, do you think it would be different?
Yes, because there's more satisfying. You don't have to wait for the next morning to find out what the results of the polls were to find out whether they had actually won a national championship.
Be reliant on pollsters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then I would say Seahawks. I would put Sounders ahead of Mariners.
Really?
Yeah.
After watching the Game 7 of the World Series when the Cubs won the World Series, I feel like Mariners winning a World Series would be pretty exciting.
It would be because of the fact that, like with the Seahawks, the whole city would come together behind it in a way that they're probably not going to with MLS Cup. But still, there's more personal investment with the Sounders than there is in the Mariners, for sure.
Yeah. It's true, though. It's a weird thing where, like, I don't feel... If the Sounders are going to lose, I don't feel it in the pit of my stomach.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, Sounders lost.
I think kind of how you know more than, like, how you feel about a win. It's how you feel about a loss.
Yes. So what should we be rooting for this week? Because it still hasn't been decided who they're playing or where they're playing.
That is true. The one thing we do know is the final will be Saturday, December 10th at 5 p.m. on the network Fox.
Okay.
But we'll find out the Sounders.
That's probably going against a Husky basketball game. Husky basketball will have managed to schedule a game immediately opposite that.
Amazingly, no. So we will find out the opponent on Wednesday. Today, if you're listening to this podcast when it comes out, is the Montreal Impact visit Toronto FC in the second leg of their Eastern Conference Championship Series. And Montreal has a 3-2 lead after the first leg, but Toronto got those two crucial road goals. So a 1-0 win, a 2-1 win for Toronto, both of those win the series for them.
But wait, did you explain who we're cheering for?
Oh, and we're cheering for Montreal, because if Montreal wins, the Sounders host.
Okay.
If Toronto wins, the Sounders will have to travel to Toronto for the final.
Wow, so we could be going to our first ever MLS Cup.
That is not true.
Wait, we could be going to our second ever MLS Cup.
We went to MLS Cup back in the Super Bowl-ish days when they hosted it in a neutral venue, and we, in a desultory raid, watched the Real Salt Lake defeat the LA Galaxy on penalty kicks when Landon Donovan missed a crucial PK.
Yeah, we saw Landy miss a PK. That was one of my favorite soccer moments.
Really?
That was one of the better live soccer moments we've experienced.
I mean, it was a memorable one.
This beer is so warm.
Right? It is.
You feel it all the way through your body.
We'll see how we feel it by the end of the podcast. But anyway, so we're all becoming enormous Montreal fans for the day.
Didier Drogba?
Yeah.
I've always liked him. Is he going to play?
So apparently there's a thing where he's not playing on turf.
Okay.
But I'm assuming he's playing on turf at this point.
It's one match.
Yeah.
This is the hugest match of his entire career.
I mean, that could also potentially be an issue in the final.
Just imagine where the Sounders Didier Drogba plays in an MLS Cup final. It'll be just like playing in the World Cup for him.
The biggest moment of his soccer career, for sure.
Well, go Montreal Impact.
I have never been such a big Montreal Impact fan.
Yeah.
Just as last week, I was briefly an enormous Minnesota Golden Gopher fan.
That was a good day when you were a Golden Gopher fan. Should we talk about that, or should we talk about Husky basketball first?
Let's talk about Husky basketball.
Okay, I think we have to. We have a lot of things to celebrate, and this is not one of them.
I think we want to finish with Husky football.
Okay.
That's the capper this week. Husky basketball last weekend traveled to Las Vegas to play in the Global Classic. I think that's the name of that tournament. Okay. I've already forgotten it because it doesn't matter.
If nobody sees it, does it still count?
They got a very impressive win on the day after Thanksgiving, beating Western Kentucky 86-47. And then on Saturday, they faced TCU in what I guess was the championship of that speak, and lost 93-80 in a game that they were down early and never really that close.
Okay. What does it mean?
I mean, I think on balance, it was a better weekend for UW. Like, UW comes out of this weekend in better position. They destroyed a Western Kentucky team that, you know, had a chance, I think, to be competitive with them. It was probably their best performance of the season so far. Unquestionably their best performance of the season so far. And they actually still are now, so they're now ranked, after this weekend, 78th on KenPom.com in his rankings. The exact same as they were at the start of the season before losing to Yale.
Oh, well.
Which is kind of fascinating. I mean, obviously that's not good enough either way. You need to get better than 78th, but it does say something, I guess. So what's weird about this, as we discussed last week on the podcast, is after losing to TCU in Las Vegas on a neutral court, the Huskies will turn around and 4 days later, they will play tonight, Wednesday night, at TCU in Fort Worth.
It's a neutral and home. Neutral and road for the Huskies.
This is actually two consecutive years that the Huskies have played the same team twice in the non-conference.
Also, both from Texas.
That is true. This is a little different because of the fact that, in that case, both of those games were on neutral sites. And
in foreign countries.
Yes. And not back-to-back games, which makes this especially weird.
So this is a weird situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a home-and-home series, except that neither of them are in Seattle.
Do you see anything going differently the second time around versus TCU?
I mean, you know, Ken Pomeroy's projection is for a 25% chance of winning and a 7-point differential in this one.
Okay.
So it's certainly realistic that they could change things. I think TCU is a particularly bad matchup for UW for a few reasons. Some of which didn't even really show up in that game necessarily. They're really good at forcing turnovers, which is something UW tends to do, is turn the ball over.
Okay.
They had 18 of them on Saturday. And then they're an exceptionally accurate shooting team. 53.7% on two-point attempts, 40.4% on threes, and lo and behold, they shot 59% on twos in that game on Saturday, and 39% on threes, and just torched a UW defense that so far has not been very good at all. The other thing that stands out about TCU when you look at them, and I think Jamie Dixon, we're already seeing his impact on that program with how well they're playing a year after, I think, going 2-16 in Big Ten play. The incredible balance they have. 8 players so far averaging at least 8 points per game for the Horned Frogs.
Really?
So this could be a very tough one.
Where
first
true
road game.
KenPom?
They only rank 54th still.
They seem like a pretty good team if they're able to force turnovers and hit shots.
Yeah, that was a little perplexing to me.
Have they lost yet this year?
They have not lost this year. They barely got past the host UNLV in their first game of the Global Classic, won that one 63-59. And then also at home, they played a competitive game with Illinois State, winning 80-71. So
Illinois State's a good team, though, right?
They're about the same as UW in the rankings.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. So but there's probably what the Huskies are going to lose by.
That's more or less what I would expect going into this game, yeah.
Yeah. There's about a 25% chance victory.
That seems realistic. I think maybe 20.
Okay.
No.
Things are slightly worse. How did Markelle Fultz fare in Vegas?
So he had, you know, a relative off shooting night in the opener against Western Kentucky, as well as the Huskies played. That was really more about, you know, Malik Dime went off in that one for shot five. I'm sorry, not Malik Dime. David Crisp went off in that one and scored. What did David Crisp do? No, he didn't either. It was Dominic Green, who had 20 points on 4 of 6 3-point shooting. Crisp was 3 of 5 from 3-point range, but that was all 9 of his points. And it was generally really more at the defensive end of that one. The Huskies held Western Kentucky to 27.5% 2-point shooting, 18.8% from 3. Anyway, Fultz in that one shot 3 of 14, but he also had 10 assists, 8 rebounds, came within 2 rebounds and a point of the first triple-double in program history. And then
we've never had a triple-double ever.
Never had a triple-double. It seems inevitable at some point that Fultz is going to get a triple-double. He's already been so close a couple of times. Then against TCU, he was limited by foul trouble in that game. Eventually ended up fouling out after 25 minutes. He scored 27 points in those 25 minutes. But that's, I guess, the best hope for the Huskies is that if Markelle Fultz is not in foul trouble and he can do something similar, then who knows?
Really ludicrous that he'd be in foul trouble. I mean, the thing is, you're reminded when watching college basketball again just how horrible college basketball is to watch.
So I watched a lot of college basketball last week with all the tournaments and it being on during the day. And it turns out it's not actually that horrible when you watch other teams play college basketball.
It's just the Huskies. Or just the Pac-12.
The Pac-12 to a lesser extent, but mostly just the Huskies.
Okay, there you go.
So it's
strong
sad.
Words. College basketball, not that horrible to watch.
It's sad. Did you see the highlight of
That's
Michael
a hot,
Porter?
Hot take.
Did you see the highlight of Michael Porter throwing the ball to himself off the backboard and dunking?
Oh my God.
That was making the rounds on Twitter. Our cousin Katie retweeted it. That's how I saw it. And I saw that highlight and it was like, man, it's going to be depressing when he's sitting on the bench with four fouls next year. Like, that was honestly my thought. That's how I think about Husky basketball
right.
at this point.
I wonder who his coach is going to be.
Markelle Fritch.
I mean, it's just absurd that Markelle Fultz would be on the bench in foul trouble. They should do everything they can, humanly possible, to not let players like Markelle Fultz get in foul trouble. But the NCAA wants them on the bench.
It's also really horrible from like a scouting perspective. Imagine you're a scout who has traveled to Las Vegas specifically to watch Markelle Fultz, and then you don't get to watch him. I forget. There was a game I was watching this weekend because obviously I don't really care that much about college basketball at this point. I'm mostly watching these games from an NBA perspective, and someone got two early fouls. It was Monte Morris from Iowa State, and he got two early fouls in the game I was watching, sat on the bench the entire half, and it was like, well, that was wasted.
Yeah.
Like, there was no purpose in me watching that half. So.
Well, great.
College basketball!
I can't wait. Hey. We should really be happy about how much sports is going on right now.
To distract us from this?
Yes. Not to distract us from this, because when it gets to January, February, March, this is all we've got. At least locally.
It's true. Sounders season will already have started by then, fortunately. That's the good news.
It'll have never ended.
It's such a short offseason when
you
make the MLS Cup.
If you play the MLS final, you actually begin the season a week later.
That's true.
A solid week off. We'll see if Clint will be back.
It's like the Nick Saban joke about, or not joke, but there was a line in a feature about Nick Saban where he was upset that they went to the national championship game because it meant he got a late start in recruiting. Yeah. It's kind of like that with the MLS offseason. Should we talk about the Seahawks? Must we? Is what your expression
No, things are fine.
Say.
Things are fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was the Seattle Times on their podcast this week that, or something. The headline was like, you know, is it time to panic about the Seahawks? Like, guys, they're 7-3-1. They beat one of the best teams in the NFL 2 weeks ago. They beat the best team by DVOA last week. Like, let's all remain calm. This was a bad game. It's not a cause for panic.
It was a bad game, and I think we knew going in that it was going to be tough. It felt like a trap game from almost every aspect.
I don't know. I don't know that I necessarily believe in trap games. I mean, what I think is I've just come to terms with the fact that a few times each season, the Seahawks offense is going to play extremely terribly.
Seems like it's been quite a few times already this season.
This
but
is number three. I would count LA, Arizona in this.
You mean the three games they didn't score a touchdown?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would count those. But but it's happening a little bit too often, right?
And it seems, you know, it's tough to say how much of it in this game. Obviously, most of the injuries were on the defensive side of the football, where the Seahawks ended up playing quite well after struggling on the first two drives and giving up touchdowns. But it seemed like the Justin Britt injury maybe had more impact than any of those on defense, despite the fact that it was to guys like Earl Thomas and then obviously Michael Bennett, who's been out for a while.
Yes. But so we talk about the defense, and I think part of it, right, is they're getting settled with all these new defensive players. I think Tampa Bay came out very hot and very strong. But at the same time, if you look at it at the end of the game, it was a great defensive performance, right?
Yeah. I mean,
giving up points at the beginning may have been a little bit demoralizing for the offense. It kind of felt like if
it shouldn't have been.
If the game was 5-0, though, all of a sudden that feels like it's a commanding lead.
I suppose. But 14-5 should not feel like an insurmountable lead. And I mean, there's a lot of scenarios where I feel like if one or two things go differently, the game might play out differently. If Russell Wilson doesn't throw an interception on the last drive of the first half, the Seahawks hit a field goal there. It's a one-score game going into halftime. It's just got a different tenor at that point.
There are a lot of little things that led to the Seahawks scoring 5 points.
But ultimately, you look at it and say this was a failing offensive performance by any standard.
Do you think that you had quick reads this week, right?
I don't generally read that, actually.
Okay, do you think that Russell Wilson has ever had a week before this where he was dead last among quarterback DR?
Probably not. We were discussing during the game whether this was Russell Wilson's worst performance ever. I went with at St. Louis, his rookie season.
It's in the conversation for his worst performance ever.
It is. And I mean, a lot of this was, again, contextual. He was under pressure constantly all game. You're also, I mean, obviously Quick Reads is factoring this in, but the fact that he was so effective as a runner mitigates that a little bit to me.
Yeah. At the same time, coming out of this game, you see all of the other NFC West teams lost. Most of them are pretty much completely done for the playoffs, right? The best odds for any other NFC West team is 3%.
Yeah, I mean, the Seahawks, barring catastrophe, are going to win the NFC West. The question and the concern based on this loss is strictly the possibility of getting the number two seed and now just a half game up on the Atlanta Falcons. And in this case, the tiebreaker, them holding the tiebreaker with the head-to-head win is basically irrelevant because of the fact that the Seahawks have a tie and therefore are going to win any scenario where they have the same number of wins.
Yeah, there's no chance of tying with them unless they get a
tie.
Yeah,
don't. I mean, well, you look around the NFL, they're ripe for more ties. Almost had one on Sunday night.
So it doesn't feel like there's any reason to panic, though.
No, I don't think so.
It's 1 week. It was one game. Let's move on.
But I don't know if we can entirely move on because I feel like we've got to discuss some big picture things here.
Okay.
And that's, I want to talk about Seahawks fans against Jermaine Kearse.
Okay, we need to talk about Jermaine Kearse.
We do. Jermaine Kearse is a guy who, yeah, the first year of this podcast, for those of you who are new listeners, we sponsored the Pro Football Reference Jermaine Kearse page. I think we got 2 clicks off of it.
Nice.
Ever.
It's $15 well spent.
It wasn't about the clicks. It was about the principle of supporting Jermaine Kearse and knowing that he was going to come up big in the playoffs, which he did with a touchdown in the NFC Championship game and in the Super Bowl. And then the winning touchdown in the NFC Championship game the next year. We didn't take advantage of that. Sadly, Pro Football Reference and Sports Reference has gotten rid of page sponsorships, so we can no longer sponsor the Jermaine Kearse page. But we would if we could.
Yeah.
That's how strongly we feel about this guy who is a local native from Lakewood who played at UW and now has made himself into a starting receiver on the Seahawks as an undrafted rookie.
Okay, so I understand his resume, right? We get this. But right now, you need to make the case for Jermaine Kearse as a receiver on the current team. Not do we like him. Because you're the biggest Jermaine Kearse defender there is.
I think that we do need to make the case. I think that's the provides
that he went to
here.
Lakewood and went to UW. We all know that. Great. He had a problem with drops at UW.
He did.
Undrafted free agent.
Drops are overrated. Okay. I wrote about it on Football Outsiders many years ago. You can go look that up.
Yeah, go ahead and link that.
I don't know. That article probably does not exist anymore. So let's be clear. This has not been a good year for Jermaine Kearse.
Wow. You're admitting it.
No, I mean, there's no argument there. Like, he's been one of the least effective receivers by Football Outsiders metrics this year. He, among qualifying receivers, is 6th from the bottom in DR. And the names ahead of him are, Tavon Austin, Jeremy Curley, Alan Hearns, Nelson Aguilar, Quentin Patton?
Quentin.
The fact that there are 2 49ers on that list.
they should name the last spot in DVOA after Tavon Austin. It should be the Tavon Austin inaugural last spot in DVOA award.
But let's talk about where Jermaine Kearse was in 2015. I also didn't mention the 5 offensive pass interference penalties. Like, that's obviously something he's got to clean up and operate differently. Last year, do you want to know where Jermaine Kearse ranked in DVOA on a per-play basis?
Where was that?
5th in the entire NFL.
It's kind of crazy. What's going on with Jermaine Kearse?
I mean, first off, it's something that's going on with all of the Seahawks offense outside of Doug Baldwin and Jimmy Graham.
Okay.
I mean, you know, part of the reason he's still playing so much is because Paul Richardson and Tyler Lockett, partially because of injuries in Lockett's case, have not been good
and
enough to take
Paul
his job.
Paul Richardson's case.
I mean, Richardson's coming back from injuries, but this is who he is at this point. Like, yeah. I don't think we should expect something dramatically different from Paul Richardson.
And Pete kind of blamed him for the interception that happened at the end of the first half.
He did. That was definitely implicit in some of his comments there. It wasn't entirely clear. That was my first thought watching the film, watching that live, watching the replay. It wasn't as clear, but his advanced stats have actually been pretty decent this year. Lockett has been not a whole lot more effective than Jermaine Kearse this year, but Lockett last year was phenomenal. Same thing, where you got to look at the larger sample. Curse weirdly has had this like even odd split where in odd years, 2013, 2015, he's been terrific by DVOA. Even years, he's been not good at all. I assume his true ability lies somewhere in the middle.
Okay, so your argument is wait until next year.
My argument is that you look at the larger sample, which is my argument in all of life, that the larger sample is usually more predictive than just looking at this season.
All of life.
And getting too high or low based on a small sample size. But the other thing I think that needs to come into play here is people think of this as like, and Daryl Bevel is a big part of this conversation too. Because people think that
You're so fired up about this.
Daryl Bevel, I am very fired about this. People like view Daryl Bevel as this like omnipotent being who is like everything the Seahawks do is directing it, and Pete Carroll is completely uninvolved.
Yeah, and Pete Carroll takes no blame whatsoever.
The fact that, yeah,
he only gets credit for things.
Because Pete Carroll, A, hired Daryl Bevel and continues to employ him. So if you're upset at Daryl Bevel, like by transitive property, you should also be upset at Pete Carroll.
Somehow I blame John Schneider.
But B, like there's a lot of philosophically what the Seahawks offense does is coming from Pete Carroll. Like I think a legitimate criticism of the Seahawks offense is that they are not very good in the red zone. Not a legitimate criticism is that they are not very good overall because they were number one in the NFL in DVOA last year. But they haven't been very good in the red zone. I think part of that is because they are very conservative and not wanting to have turnovers or go backwards in the red zone because their philosophy is if we get field goals, we will win the game with our defense.
Okay.
So I think that's something that has to be taken into consideration. And then there's also Russell Wilson, who is a person with feelings and is involved. You know who's... You know,
what does that have to do with anything?
He's not a computer.
Okay.
You know who's part of the reason the Seahawks throw to Jermaine Kearse so much? Russell Wilson, who is the quarterback, decides where to throw passes.
Okay.
And I think Russell Wilson has great trust in Jermaine Kearse based on his success over a number of years. And he's not just looking at what's happened this season.
You're saying Russell Wilson is judging the larger sample.
I think so.
Wow. A lot of faith in Russell Wilson. I mean, you should have a lot of faith in Russell Wilson.
Yeah. I mean, come on. He's
but
Russell
what
Wilson.
Is happening with Jermaine Kearse right now? Is he not getting separation? Why is he not making catches? Why is he not making plays?
I mean, I think there is an element of the inconsistency that plagued him at UW. You know, you mentioned that with his case of the drops, and that was really like his senior year he struggled. His junior year, he had a big year, and for some reason, he's up and down much more than other receivers.
I agree with you in the one aspect, which is there's basically nobody else. Tyler Lockett has been on the field. Right? If Tyler Lockett is open, he's getting passes thrown to him. I don't think Paul Richardson needs to see more action here.
It's Daryl Bevel is just like commanding Russell Wilson, don't you dare throw to Tyler Lockett.
You're so angry about this.
But here's the other thing.
Oh no, there's another thing.
It's like, we're all on the same team here.
Yes.
Why is this got to be separated? Why does it have to be Daryl Bevel versus Seahawks fans or Seahawks fans versus Tom Cable or versus Jermaine Kearse? Like, I'm not saying that you shouldn't criticize people or think critically about the performance of the team or that you should have blind faith in them, but I get the sense that there are like Seahawks fans who are actually excited when the team fails because of the fact that they get to complain about these players.
About Jermaine Kearse? You think people are that mad at Jermaine Kearse that they're excited when he fails?
I don't know about Jermaine Kearse necessarily, but Bevel. I do feel that with Daryl Bevel, that people were excited about last week, that they got to complain about Daryl Bevel, and it was a bummer 2 weeks ago that the team did so well and they couldn't say anything. Like, I honestly believe that.
Okay.
Like, we're all on trying to do the same thing here. I think an important thing in my life as a sports fan was at some point I realized that you can't judge coaches based on what would I do in this situation? Did they do what I would do in this situation? Because it turns out that no one would do exactly the same thing as you in every situation. And a lot of the time, that's for the better and not for the worse, because you are not the residue of all knowledge in the world.
Okay.
And that's how I feel about this.
Okay. All right. So somehow that had to do with Jermaine Kearse.
Got some stuff off my chest.
Wow. I'm going to need another sip of this B-bomb here.
So you want to talk about the Panthers?
Oh, man. Hope Jermaine Kearse has a good game this week.
I do, too.
Okay, we've seen the Panthers before, right? I still don't feel over this Jermaine Kearse conversation. I mean, it was a lot to handle.
You need a moment?
9 red zone targets and no catches.
Is that it?
I think that's it.
That's bad.
So we've seen the Panthers before. We've seen great Jermaine Kearse catches against the Panthers before.
We have. What is this, 5 years in a row the Seahawks have played the Panthers? Dating back to Russell's rookie season?
Every single season that Russell Wilson has been in the NFL, he's played the Panthers. Sometimes twice.
Yeah, a total of 7 games it's now insane. Over the last 5 years.
It really doesn't make sense. If only we could play the Browns more. What is different about this Panthers team than previous Panthers teams?
Yeah, they're not as good, it turns out.
Okay.
I don't know if you noticed that from the fact that they are functionally eliminated from the playoffs at this point after going to the Super Bowl last year, but they haven't been as good. And it really, you can't separate it down to one thing because it's happened kind of all over the board.
I'm really thinking we blame Jermaine Kearse for this.
Yes. That's, I don't know who the Carolina equivalent of Jermaine Kearse is.
Do you think it's Ted Ginn? They probably love Ted Ginn.
I don't know. Ted Ginn is someone who is not playing as well this year as he did last year. Cam Newton.
You know, they were great before they had Kelvin Benjamin back.
Even though Kelvin Benjamin has been their best receiver by far. Let's start with the offensive line. Because it is now a shadow of what it was last season. Of the 5 guys who started the season, which was basically, I think, the same group, which was the same group as last year. By the end of the Oakland game that they played last Sunday and lost in Oakland, one player was playing at their original position.
To begin the season?
Yeah.
Who is that?
That was left guard Andrew Norwell.
Okay.
So Michael Orr has gone on IR after suffering a concussion. Ryan Khalil missed last week's game and then subsequently was placed on IR. His backup, Gino Gradkowski, suffered a knee injury in that game and was placed on IR. Also in that game, so Mike Remmers moved from right tackle to left tackle to replace Orr, and they brought in Daryl Williams at right tackle, and Daryl Williams got injured against Oakland, and then they decided to move their right guard, Trey Taylor, out to right tackle, a position he had not played since high school.
Nice. The Seahawks starting left tackle was playing basketball last year.
That's true. Then on the last play, we didn't really talk about Joey Hunt that much, but then on the last play of the game, Khalil Mack beat Trey Turner for a strip sack that won the game for Oakland.
So
it wasn't super great. And on Monday, Ron Rivera described the strain of the offensive line and the injuries is a catastrophe.
So it's a good thing that Michael Bennett may be coming back.
It's an ideal time for that. So like I said, they're not getting Orr back. They're not getting Khalil back. They signed Ryan Wendell, who played for the Patriots, started at guard for them in the Super Bowl against the Seahawks before that game was unexpectedly canceled with 2 minutes left. he may have a chance to start at center for them this week after just being on the street.
Okay. Seems great. No chance of Cam Newton being hit.
Don't know the status of Daryl Williams yet, but yeah, that's a problem. And so you see this manifest itself all across their offense. Cam's getting sacked more than last season. Their run game has completely fallen apart. Jonathan Stewart's only averaging 3.6 yards per carry. And even Cam isn't running as effectively as he did last year, both in terms of number of attempts or yards per attempt. And then Cam isn't completing as many as high a percentage of his passes. He's at a career low 56%. He's never been a real accurate passer, but even by his standards, at an extremely low percentage this year, all adds up to a pretty mediocre offense at this point.
So this could be because of the offensive line. This could be the run game not opening things up as much as possible for the Panthers. We don't know exactly why, but overall, it means that they're not moving the ball the way that they have previously moved the ball.
No, not even close, and not holding on to the ball. That's been a feature of these games, is these long Carolina drives. I'm not going to rule that out because Kelvin Benjamin has played pretty well for them this year. And Greg Olsen is still one of the league's best receiving tight ends. He's number 2 in receiving DR behind Jimmy Graham. So there's a chance for them to move the football in this game. But I think you're going to be looking at a lot of third and longs based on their inability to run the ball.
What about defensively? In the past, they've had a pretty strong defense.
They have. And again, and they're not bad this year. They're 10th in DVOA, but not nearly as dominant as they were last season. So the first place you look at is they lost Josh Norman, decided inexplicably to pull their tag on him and let him leave for Washington. And last year they were 3rd in DVOA against number 1 receivers. This year they have dropped to 23rd.
Oh my God.
Replacing him with a bunch of young players in the secondary. It's a lot like 2 years ago where they struggled getting into the playoffs before finally winning the NFC South with a sub-500 record and eventually playing the Seahawks in the playoffs. But then on top of that, They've also had some injuries there. Luke Kuechly missed last week's game with a concussion. Don't know what his status
for this week. It seems unlikely, doesn't
Couldn't really find much of anything, but yeah, it does seem like a long shot. And then Mario Addison, their best pass rusher, missed last week's game with a foot injury. So you add that up, and even though their run defense has still been really stout, they've got that great interior line combination, Star Lotulelei, Kawan Short, Paul Soliai off the bench. That's a really great defensive tackle rotation, and they're fifth against the run so far this year. Only gave up 55 yards in 30 attempts to Oakland last week.
Really? So Oakland still didn't run the ball? Because I was thinking that what we're looking at is the whole season, including 9 weeks of Luke Kuechly.
No, they really... AJ Klein came in for him, and I think did a pretty good job against the run. Where it was more of an issue, really, was in the passing game and him trying to defend over the middle. I mean, obviously, they've got one of the best cover linebackers in the NFL in Thomas Davis, and I would expect to see him matched up with Jimmy Graham a lot, but... maybe that's an opportunity for the Seahawks to get the ball to their running backs out of the backfield, something they did not do last weekend.
No. Did a running back have a catch?
I would have to look that up, but I don't recall it.
I don't think so.
It was somewhat mysterious, the lack of screen passes or draws against that Tampa Bay pass rush that was constantly in Russell Wilson's face.
Darryl Bell was perfect, though.
That was not my argument.
Maybe this will be the kind of week, though, that the Seahawks are able to get things going to their wide receivers a little bit more.
Yeah, I think so. And it is interesting. They've not been very victimized necessarily by deep passes. They've really struggled more underneath so far this year. So I don't know quite what to make of that in conjunction with everything else we've talked about.
So there's no obvious spot. I mean,
George Farmer did have one catch for 4 yards.
Nice. Do the Panthers still scare you?
They don't. I mean, the fact that they were in that game against
they
Oakland...
don't scare you?
No. I mean, this. No, they don't.
You don't have an appropriate enough fear.
I respect them, but I don't think they're a great matchup for the Seahawks anymore.
Okay.
I mean, the fact that they were competitive in Oakland, it had something to do with the fact that Matt McGloin came in for a series there for Derek Carr when he got injured. But I don't know. I mean,
they're
just not the same
place
team.
To me where the Seahawks, especially offensively, I mean, the thing that feels best about it, offense, Seahawks offense versus the Panthers defense, because I don't see this Panthers offense generating too many points.
No.
But the place that I feel best about in general is the Seahawks offense. But in this game, I just don't see the one thing that they can really exploit. The only thing that feels really good about it to me is how bad they played last week and how unlikely they are to play that badly 2 weeks in a row, especially on a Sunday night at home.
I mean, I don't know that the fact that you played poorly actually causes you to play better the next week. It's unlikely just because of the fact that, you know, it's like...
you just compete a little bit harder.
I suppose. I don't think the offense is going to put up a lot of points in this game. I think it's going to be a classic Seahawks-Panthers game from the standpoint that it's low scoring, but maybe more possessions than we're used to, more punts, and that's one thing. The Panthers' special teams are terrible. They're 29th in the league. And I think that's a place where I can see a critical play in this game that decides it. They have been allowing 12 yards per punt return, second most in the NFL.
Really?
So I think a big punt return in this game could be a factor.
Interesting. Haven't seen too much from the punt return game.
That was a little Kevin Domus for you.
Really?
Yeah.
My Tristan Domus would be... I don't think this is this classic Panthers-Seahawks game like we saw for a couple seasons where they were 13-9, things like that, right? I think the Seahawks get out in front, maintain that lead. Maybe it's a 20-6 game.
That seems reasonable.
I don't think they're going to score a ton of points, but the Seahawks offense is going to move the ball. There's no way that they're going to play that badly 2 weeks in a row. I'm excited to see Justin Britt back. I think this defense is going to be hyped up, though. I mean, this defense having... I think everybody could be back, right?
It seems possible. I mean, Pete Carroll was really optimistic when he was talking about this the other day on the coach's show.
Because there's nobody, right? If Earl, Deshaun, Mike Morgan, and Michael Bennett all play, is there anybody out? And Brock Coyle?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, you basically have your entire defense.
That's amazing to have everybody back. And the Seahawks have been very lucky, a big knock on wood, to not have season-ending injuries. They've had a lot of small injuries, but nothing that has caused people to go on IR, right? They have basically nobody on IR at this point.
There is CJ Procise.
Is he on IR?
I guess he's not on IR, but
no,
he's a long-term injury.
CJ coming back.
Mike Morgan Mike Morgan was the guy who was on IR, but was on the designated to return.
And especially on the defensive side, right? So having all of these guys back, seems like Mike Morgan is very ready to go. I could see this defense being very fired up to play a team that they've seen so many times and knock them out of the playoffs last year. Look, even though the Panthers aren't what they used to be, this is still a big game for the Seahawks.
So a revenge game?
Yeah, it's Sunday night. It's a revenge game. We've seen this team so many times, and I could see this defense ready to go.
Are you surprised that this game is still on Sunday night?
Not really, because of those. I mean, Cam Newton's still a star.
Right. The Cam Newton-Russell Wilson matchup is certainly sellable.
Even though their record isn't as good, like I said, the Panthers are still a little bit scary. They did go to the Super Bowl last year.
That's an important thing to remember.
They were favored. They were heavy favorites in the Super Bowl last year.
That is true.
So I don't think I'm necessarily surprised about that. For the same reason that you continue to see the Packers on Sunday night, they've got star players. They have marketable players. And these are two teams that have played each other so many years in a row that a rivalry has really developed here.
It has, yeah. I mean, that's the one thing is whether with all the injuries on the Carolina side, you still have the same level of rivalry.
Percentage chances of victory for the Seahawks?
I think about 65.
Oh, I was going to say 75%.
Really?
Yeah.
I was surprised that the line for this game was only Seahawks by 6.5. That seems a little low to me.
I think that's...
I mean, maybe it's an acknowledgement that this is going to be a relatively low scoring
game.
Yeah,
it's a touchdown.
But if you assume that
spreads that much higher than that.
Well, if you assume that these teams, if home field is about 3.5 points, do you think the Seahawks are only 3 points better than Carolina on a neutral field at this point?
Maybe I would have seen
that seems a little
7.5 or something.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel too far off.
All right.
And I think the Seahawks win by a little bit more than that. I think they cover the spread. They win by about 10.
That seems reasonable.
And then we can just stop talking about this. Jermaine Curse has a huge game. I actually really want, in the same way that you have people who cheer for Daryl Bevel to have a bad game, I'm definitely cheering for Jermaine Curse to have a huge game.
I'm always cheering for Jermaine Curse to have a huge game because he's on the Seahawks. I'm cheering for Tyler Lockett to have a huge game too. Like, it's not a competition.
Yes.
They're on the same team. We're all pulling together here, guys.
I actually, if we can hold on for 1 second before we move on to the Huskies, I do think that running the ball, now having Russell Wilson as this option, I think it's going to open up huge things in the run game for Thomas Rawls. And I could see
it's surprising because the overall numbers were not that good on Sunday. It felt like Rawls was running the ball quite well.
It seems like they could have been, right?
Because of the fact that they got away from it?
Did you hear Pete say there was one play where Russell tried to pull it back from Rawls and he kept it? Do you remember that? We were talking about that. We thought Russell had made the wrong read, but Rawls wouldn't give him the ball back.
Oh, Rawls kept it. Oh, okay. That makes some sense. But Rawls ended up 12 for 38 in this game. It's not great.
I think he goes for over 100 yards against the Panthers.
Oh, there's Nostra Tristan coming up.
It's going to be huge. I think this is going to be a classic Seahawks run game. All of a sudden, I've talked myself into the offense playing really well.
You really have.
Things are going to be opened up. They're going to have Russell running the ball on tape. They're going to be a little bit more scared of it, right? But also, it's just going to open things up more everywhere. This is what that does. It's what happened at the end of last season, and now we've got Thomas Rawls back who can run in the system.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious if we see more RPO run-pass options in this one. I think there was maybe one play on Sunday that looked like a classic run-pass option, but that's another thing that's opened up by Russell Wilson starting to run the ball.
It was the intermediate week last week. All of a sudden, everything's going to click into place this week.
That is a very optimistic Pete Carroll-esque statement.
Let's talk about the Huskies. Do we have one last toast in us?
We've got just enough for one last toast, right. I would say. Yeah, to making the Pac-12 championship for the first time in program history, even though we sort of also already celebrated that on last week's impromptu podcast.
But let's celebrate...
being number 4 in the college football playoff rankings?
The college football playoff rankings, and not just being number 4. So there was a scenario that we talked about on last week's podcast, which was we were nervous about either Penn State or Wisconsin, who subsequently won.
Both of them subsequently won.
Either of those teams jumping ahead of the Huskies in the college football playoff if they won the Big Ten championship.
So the fact that they're still behind Michigan seems to suggest that that's not likely to happen, although I'm not ruling it out.
You're still not ruling it out? I'm not ruling it out.
I'm not ruling out anything. It's 2016. It's the year of the underdog.
I mean, I wouldn't rule out them putting Michigan back in, right?
Let's also not rule out the Huskies losing this game.
Well, we're obviously speaking in the hypothetical world where the Huskies have won.
But I'm telling you, I'm nervous about this game.
I want to talk about the college football playoff first for 1 second.
Okay.
Obviously, I'm nervous about this game. What are you talking about? This is the most important game since probably 1991.
I think there were games in 2000 that were this important. I don't know.
Maybe the 2000 Rose Bowl.
2000 at Oregon, in hindsight.
the fact that Penn State was at number, or I think Wisconsin was number 6, Penn State number 7.
Yes.
Makes it seem like if one of those teams has to win, right?
That is the definition of the Big Ten championship game.
Let's say that Penn State
tie.
Beats number 7. Or let's say
they
that
would be number 6. Wisconsin would be number 7.
Wisconsin beats number 7, right? Is that much better of a win than UW beating number 8?
No.
I mean, the difference is negligible there, yes. Right? It's not enough to have them jump up 2 spots.
And so the other comment specifically, I can't remember who the chair of the committee is, was asked about...
Condoleezza Rice.
Yeah. Tyrone Williams. was asked about the Seahawks versus Michigan, the Huskies versus Michigan.
Barry Alvarez.
I should say, and said that it was very, very close between those two teams.
Ooh.
But the point is, it was very, very close before the Huskies played in the Pac-12 championship. If the Huskies add that to their resume, then it's no longer close with Michigan.
Yes. This is in a hypothetical world where the Huskies have just beaten a top 10 team on a neutral site.
Yes. I mean, I do think it's important for them to not only win, but make a statement if they have the ability to do so. But that might be difficult. Because I'm nervous about Colorado.
Should be nervous about Colorado.
This is a you know, so the other thing we wished for on last week's podcast in the wake of the Apple Cup win was for Colorado to win and be the opponent instead of a rematch with USC. And there's an element of be careful what you wish for here, because this is a tough matchup. This is a team that fits a lot of UW's weaknesses with their strengths, I would say. Or strengths with their strengths, I guess.
Would you say that Colorado is almost a mirror image of UW?
I wouldn't necessarily say that, because they're certainly not as effective offensively as UW. They're not as efficient in the pass game in particular. But defensively, I think that's a fair statement.
So let's talk about first Colorado with the ball going against the Husky defense.
I mean, I think first we should take a moment to pause and note how incredible that is that Colorado is here.
Oh, yeah. I was looking at their rankings throughout every week. As of October 23rd, they were number 23 in the country. And before then, they were unranked. The fact that they've not only gotten here as a team, where were they picked to finish in the Pac-12 before the season?
I don't know that, but it was not high.
So not only that, but also that even as of a month ago, they were not even in the top 25.
I mean, I was looking at it from the fact that 2 years ago, they were 2-10. So Mike McIntyre has done kind of the classic rebuilding thing here. This is his fourth year at Colorado, and all of a sudden there's a team dominated by seniors.
Yes.
Some of them redshirt seniors, fifth-year guys, but a lot of them guys he recruited who haven't played for anyone else, who all of a sudden have... After getting their heads beaten in basically the first 3 years they were there, the best of which was a 4-8 season, have all of a sudden come together and become a contender in the Pac-12.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Including Sefa Lufau at quarterback, who, you know, had to start as a true freshman, took a lot of lumps, and now is getting the last laugh on a lot of people with his success this season.
So Colorado's very impressive.
Yes.
Right? So let's talk about Sefa Lufau. When Colorado has the ball.
So he's a good passer. He's fourth in the Pac-12 in yards per attempt, third if you throw out Josh Rosen, who didn't play the full season. But he's a great rusher. Only Brandon Dawkins, who, and we saw what he did against UW, has more rushing yards among Pac-12 quarterbacks this season than Lufau. Now, he's not as good as Brandon Dawkins. Like, Brandon Dawkins is a running back who plays quarterback. That's what he is. Lufau is a quarterback who runs well. There's a difference between those two. But I am very nervous given the Huskies' struggles throughout this season against mobile quarterbacks.
Sure would be nice to have Azeem Victor. I mean, this is obviously the aspect of the game that scares me the most. Is Sefa Lufau running the ball?
Is it should be.
Because the thing about Brandon Dawkins is he's explosive. If he gets in the open field, he's going to score. Sefa Lufau can pick up first downs almost at will, right?
I know at will. I think they would be 12-0 and not 10-2 if he actually picked up first downs at will.
I mean, their two losses are good losses.
They're not bad losses.
At USC. Sure. We lost to USC in our house.
That's true.
And at Michigan.
Yeah.
Those are Michigan's pretty good. Pretty good losses. I mean, Ohio State maybe would have lost at Michigan last week had it been there.
I think that's quite possible.
His ability to run the ball, not necessarily explosively, but just find holes and pick up first downs, it's both impressive and infuriating.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. I think we're going to be infuriated on Friday.
It's going to be something where it's going to be so frustrating how capable he is of finding running lanes and getting to the first down marker.
Yeah. He might be their biggest running threat in some ways. I mean, Phillip Lindsay, their running back, he's solid. He's got 15 touchdowns this year, 5.4 yards per carry, which is actually fairly average, I think, for Pac-12 starting running backs. And the interesting thing is, if anyone else but Lufau and Phillip Lindsay carries the ball, it's going to be bad. Like, their overall yards per carry is only 4.2, near the bottom of the Pac-12, despite the fact that Lindsay has been so good, and that's because of their backup running backs have been so ineffective.
I mean, 5.4 yards per carry, definitely not terrified of that, right? I think this Husky defense can stop the run if it's coming from running backs.
And if you're making them one-dimensional, I think that's going to help you, even if that may set up more Lufau runs.
What about their receivers?
Shea Fields has been a big play threat for them so far this year. He's averaging 16.4 yards per catch, which ranks fifth in the conference, and he's got four catches of 50-plus yards. Then they've got a pretty decent possession receiver in Devin Ross in the slot. One thing that we'll have to watch this week is the status of Bryce Bobo, who's their other outside receiver. He didn't play against Utah last week due to a leg injury, and there's not a ton of depth behind him. Especially because this is a team that tends to play multiple receivers, doesn't really use tight ends or fullbacks.
They need to stop Sifo-Lifau running the ball. I'm so scared of this.
As you should be.
It's the only thing that I'm scared of. They couldn't even stop Sam Darnold from running the ball.
I mean, Sam Darnold, not a bad athlete.
No, Sam Darnold's a good runner.
Sneaky athletic.
I am so terrified of this.
Like, can you sleep?
No, I can sleep.
Okay.
It's fine. But the magnitude is so high, and you could just see them maintaining drives, right? That basically what the Huskies need to do in this game is dominate every other aspect of the game. But it's going to come down to when Colorado has the ball, it's going to be a lot of pressure on those linebackers.
And I think it's important in this case to hold Colorado to field goals, not touchdowns. I think that it could be that kind of game where Yes. If you can score touchdowns and hold them to field goals, you're going to win that game, even though they move the ball between the 20s.
I mean, it could be a game that's not all that dissimilar from Wazoo last week, right?
I mean, the Huskies did win that game by four touchdowns. So I think it'll be dissimilar from that.
Okay, it might be dissimilar from that. But a game where you know going in that you're going to give up some points. They ended up getting some goal line stands in that game, which made it maybe not as close as it could have been. But it could come down to some very small things. Things like your running back making a tackle on special teams, making sure that...
We'll get to that. Let's talk about their defense first, because their defense is really the strength of this team. It's not Sifo-Lifau. It's this defense, which ranks sixth in the country. Fortunately, UW's offense ranks second, so that's a good matchup still for UW. But they start eight seniors. This is a really experienced group. And their defensive coordinator, Jim Levitt, who was the head coach at South Florida and very successful there until he was fired for allegedly hitting one of his players in the locker room, has done a great job molding this defense. Yeah. And I would say that it's a modern defense in many ways. They start three corners, generally speaking. They've got a lot of depth there. Chidobe Awuzie is considered their top corner and NFL prospect. But on the opposite side from him, Akello Witherspoon has 17 passes defensed because of the fact that teams are picking on him. That's the most in the NCAA.
God.
They also, at safety, have Tedrick Thompson, who's defensed 14 passes, which is second to Witherspoon in the Pac-12, and then also has seven interceptions so far this season, is a ball-hawking safety. And then a solid pass rush, too, led by Jimmy Gilbert, who has 10 sacks second in the Pac-12 and has forced six fumbles.
Is there any aspect that you see the Huskies having any sort of advantage?
I mean, they're really good on offense. That's okay. Their advantage.
Just being better.
But there is a little bit of concern that this is similar to the USC game, where you have quality cornerbacks who can lock up the UW receivers, take away that first option and force Jake Browning to improvise, which he struggled to do in that game.
there's nothing that's standing out, right? I think basically the different types of looks that the Huskies can throw at them, the different things that they can do, the offensive line being huge, right? The offensive line can hold up in this game, give people time to get open, and then having so many different threats offensively, whether it's John Ross, Dante Pettis, even Daryl Daniels, the threat of Dante Pettis passing the ball.
Yeah. I mean, this would be a nice game for the run game to show up. Because
and then also having the tandem of running backs.
Even though Colorado is good against the run, they're only allowing 3.9 yards per carry. It's certainly not as good as they are against the pass, where they're second in the country in yards per pass attempted behind Michigan, and opponents are only completing 49% of their passes, the fifth lowest mark in the country.
Man, this is a good team.
This is a really good defense. They're also sixth in forcing turnovers, but the good news is UW is second.
And that's the way it feels with Colorado, right? It's like the good news is this for Colorado, but then the Huskies are a little bit better at basically every single aspect of the game. What about special teams?
That's the place where I think this game is ultimately going to get decided. Because
two games in a row. Yeah,
no.
You think Friday and Sunday it's going to be all special teams?
Well, UW's special teams have actually been surprisingly mediocre given Coach Pete's track record in history with special teams. Colorado has the 117th ranked special teams in the country in ESPN's Football Power Index ratings. And I don't know how many teams are ranked, but it's not a whole heck of a lot more than 117. It's actually 128. So they are bad on special teams.
And they gave up a special teams touchdown to Jabal Preppers when they played against Michigan.
They did. And that's part of they've used three different place kickers this year.
Okay.
They've allowed 11.5 yards per punt return, including that Jabril Peppers touchdown, and 25 yards per kick return. So I feel like this is a game where you could see a big play by either Dante Pettis or John Ross in the return game.
Okay. So that's huge when you talk about the Husky defense needs to limit Colorado to field goals instead of touchdowns. If they can do that and get a big play in special teams, it could be the difference in this game.
Yeah, and it also could be a case where they're just constantly starting with better field position than Colorado because of their more effective special teams.
Yes, which is, underrated aspect of the entire game.
It is.
Right? So all of this said, what do you see happening in the game?
I think it's going to be a very close game, a tense game, and a special teams play makes the difference.
Really?
Yeah.
Percentage chances of victory for the Huskies?
I would say, again, about 60%.
It's really tough when you look at it and see that the Huskies are better in almost every aspect of the game than Colorado is. Colorado's good. I think that they'll dominate both. I think they'll have more fans there.
You think so?
I think they'll have more fans in the stadium.
Really? I think there's a lot of UW fans going.
No, the Huskies.
Oh, okay.
I think it's going to be like 70-30 UW fans.
Yeah, that seems reasonable.
I think they're slightly better on offense than Colorado is on defense. I think they're slightly better on defense than Colorado is on offense, quite a bit better. And they're a much better special teams team. So if you look at all of those factors, it's really hard to look at this as being that close of a game.
Oh.
And I think the Huskies win it by at least two touchdowns.
At least?
This is the kind of game where it feels like Colorado is just happy to be there. We've got bigger plans than this.
I don't know. I mean, I think they have big plans, although they still could go to the Rose Bowl even if they lose this game.
Like the Huskies?
No, Colorado. I'm saying...
I think USC is better, but...
Well, I mean, that'll be up to the College Football Playoff Committee because it'll be whichever is the higher ranked team.
Up to what Condi thinks. Stanford's going.
Unless UW ends up in the Rose Bowl, of course, which is a scenario even if they win. But yes, there's not the same kind of stakes for them as there is for UW is the point there.
UW have bigger plans than this. They're not happy to be there. This is a stepping stone to getting to play Alabama.
Oh, no. I want to play Ohio State.
That ain't happening.
No. Clemson could lose. Could happen.
The team that we really want to play is Michigan. We all know it.
We really want to play Michigan.
We want Michigan.
But it's not happening now. That's
just because it would be fun to play Michigan. I would love to play Jim Harbaugh.
It would be so
basically nothing that I'd want to see more than the Huskies playing against Michigan and Jim Harbaugh. But
it's too late to change that spot.
Before then, I just don't think these two teams are in the same world right now.
Wow.
Colorado's good.
I don't think you have appropriate fear.
They're probably the second best team that the Huskies have played all season.
Behind USC?
at the same time, I just think they're so much better in every single aspect of the game. It could mean that they get out ahead early, and Colorado's always fighting to come back and just can't quite get there. But I think the run game does quite well in this game. I think the defense is going to give up a lot of yards to Leafau running the ball. At the same time, I don't think we're going to give up much anywhere else. I don't see them being able to run the ball that well. I don't see Sifo Leafau being able to pass the ball that much. And I think this is the type of game where the Huskies win comfortably. It's an impressive enough victory. And next week, we're talking about preparing in 3 weeks.
Oh, I'm knocking on wood.
To play against the team of the century.
Ugh.
Which is a scary, it's crazy to think about that we're even in this position.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of unimaginable that we're really here.
I mean, we thought this team was so overrated back in the preseason.
You thought that, but okay.
All right.
You thought this team was overrated. We knew how good they were. I mean, this is still best case scenario for the season, though.
Well, I don't know about best case scenario.
Wow.
I mean, they did only lose one game. You don't think it's best case scenario that they could have won that one game?
Well, only losing one game is the best case scenario for the season.
Okay.
But I think we're talking next week about preparing for the college football playoff in 3 weeks.
Well, I hope you're right.
Man, what a crazy thought. I'm still so excited about it. You know, they announced that Sunday morning. If the Huskies win, I think it's 10 a.m. Sunday. If the Huskies win, imagine how fired up we're going to be on Sunday leading into that Seahawks game on Sunday night.
I don't want to think about
it.
It's
going to be like 12 hours of drinking.
It's going to be a lot of drinking. I mean, 12 hours of drinking would mean you were getting up at like 4 a.m. So I'm hoping that's not your plan.
It's going to be, if this all goes according to plan, it'll be...
Maybe just like 60 hours of drinking straight from Friday night.
What we're hoping for is that you have to put up Christmas lights with me on Saturday.
Oh, good.
So we shouldn't drink while doing that, because there's going to be a lot of us standing on ladders.
There's going to be a lot of you standing on ladders.
You're going to have to balance the ladder. Hold it. Put your foot on the bottom step.
It'll be completely safe then.
I also have to retrieve a toy helicopter from the roof. But what we're talking about, so unimaginable from where we were, even if the Huskies lose, the fact that we're even having this conversation, so unimaginable from where we were 2, 3, 4 years ago. And then especially
also
5, 6 years
ago.
So and now Tyrone Willingham will decide our fate. Is he actually on the committee? I don't think he is.
Isn't he?
I don't know.
He is.
Just to spite us, he'll keep us out of there.
I don't think he holds any grudge.
But it's so crazy that we're even having this conversation.
It is. I agree.
Man, this is a big week.
Yeah, it is.
So on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.